wonderful women entrepreneurs. I'm going to ask you as a first question to introduce yourself. But before I do that, I just want to give to the group a couple of statistics, which I think are very important regarding women entrepreneurs, but more importantly, Latina entrepreneurs. So between 2007 and 2012 alone, Latina-owned firm grew in number by 87%. And right now, the largest increase in business ownership in America is within the Latina female entrepreneurs. So I think that it's incredibly remarkable in a world where we always talk about women having difficulty in accessing capital, minorities in general having difficulty in accessing capital, in starting businesses, et cetera, that you all represent essentially the fastest growing entrepreneurial group in this country. And I think we should give an applause just for that, even before we start asking questions. But so I would like to kick it off with each of you introducing yourselves to the audience, but please try to do it. I was told in 30 seconds or less. Maybe I can give you 1 minute or less. But let's start with that, and then we have a lot of questions.
Okay, I am Carolina. I am a software engineer. I am 33 years old. I started to be a tech entrepreneur when I was 24. I founded Glam Street, my first company, and we sold it to Ulta last October. It was the first time that happens in Latin America for women in technology to be able to sell their company to a US company. So it was a really big deal. It was ER and VR. And now at IQ, what I am doing is machine learning and deep learning algorithms also for images. I just started this new venture, and I am really happy to be here with one of my, she's an inspiration for me when I started.
Hello, everyone. My name is Carolina Huaranca Mendoza, and it's awesome to be next to another Carolina. Also excited to be here in New York, because New York is home. So I am a venture capitalist. I work for an early seed stage fund, one of the few Latinas in venture. There need to be more. And more importantly than that, I'm also standing on the shoulder of immigrant parents from Peru, who are political exiles. So that in itself has shaped kind of my North Star in terms of always thinking about access for my community and making sure that my, now a majority, is not an invisible majority. So that's actually what drives me to invest, because I want to make sure communities like mine have access and that I can unlock that capital, because sometimes great businesses are not built because people don't have access to that capital. And ultimately, genius exists everywhere, but opportunity does not.
My name is Susie Jaramillo. I am president and chief creative officer of Encantos Media Studios. We are a family entertainment and education company creating brands inspired by our world of culture. I'm also the creator of our first brand, our baby brand, called Canticos. Canticos is a nursery rhyme brand inspired by Latino nursery rhymes. It's distributed in partnership with Nickelodeon on all the Nickelodeon platforms, and there will be a line of consumer products coming this fall.
That's amazing.
And there are more brands in the pipeline. So I'm very much committed to leveraging our culture to appeal to the mainstream, to everybody, and to really show everyone on a global level who we are as Latinos and what our culture means to everyone.
Awesome. So I'm Marie Juanita Diaz Ibarra. I'm the managing partner of Wallux. I came to America in my 20s with a scholarship to study business at Wharton. And after that, I didn't have the connections. My accent was terrible. No one was really like taking me seriously. So I worked in the corporate world for almost a decade until I actually failed. I had the confidence to start a company, to join a startup. We started Wallux, that is a software development company with a social responsibility twist. As you said, like, opportunities are everywhere. I mean, talent is everywhere, but opportunities are not. So we bring tech, brands. I mean, I do human trafficking of nerds, basically. there are very smart people in Latin America ready to develop like projects around artificial intelligence and machine learning. So we bring them to America to contribute in big projects. And
that's amazing.
Amazing. And thank you for staying on time. I'm going to do some questions to all of you, some questions to some of you, but let's keep this interactive. So anybody who has anything to add, please let's not. I'm sure you're not a shy group here. I guess the first question I want to ask is, how does your identity affect sort of who you are in terms of your career? And has your Latin background been a driving force, an advantage or a disadvantage, I presume an advantage in some ways, in what you've done so far? And I think that's a question for really everyone.
I should start? Okay.
You can go in whatever order you'd like.
I am based in Argentina. I am from Uruguay, so I started in Uruguay. And when I started, there was no venture capital, no incubators, no accelerator programs. So I started to move the system to give me what I need at the moment. So I really believe my Latina background is I become a go-getter. I start fighting for the things that I wanted. The first time I went to Stanford, it was really funny because I was 28, and there were kids that were pitching. I almost cried because nobody told me and nobody teach me how to pitch. And I spent like the last 5 years of my life trying to be a really good person who present, and these kids with 18 years old are like experts. And I feel like, oh my God, I need to start like again. I need to go to college here again. So I think that to be a Latina for me and starting from Latin America and coming here and trying to make business here has forced me to make like to rule, like to break the rules, to be a go-getter and to create that things for me.
So I would say being Latina is my superpower. Everyone here in the room has a superpower. I would also say identity is very personal. So I feel like Bertica's story around kind of straddling two worlds, like sometimes am I American enough? Am I Peruvian enough? I have this kind of bicultural identity. But it's also very intersectional because I'm multiracial. I have a grandparent who's Afro-Peruvian, and I have another one that's Cantonese-Peruvian. So when I think about what Latinx means to me, it's an ethnicity. We are all races. We are black, we're indigenous, we're white, we're Asian, we're all of it, and we're mixed. So those kind of experiences have been really important because I've noticed how when I walk into rooms, sometimes I'm treated differently. So I think in my past life, I actually was an entrepreneur before I went on the other side of the table. And I remember going to an event at a big tech company that shall remain nameless because I don't know if they're a sponsor here. So I walk into the room and I was really excited because it was a demo day and I was doing a pitch. And someone was cleaning, someone who worked there handed me a plate. That actually happens quite often. But it was a really kind of telling experience for me about what they think someone Latina is meant to do. I actually went into that pitch competition and I won it. So I think, again, your superpower, because sometimes, you know, people come in with a mindset of scarcity when you take something that is so personal to you and you change it and reframe how you see yourself in the world. So I own my power.
That's wonderful.
Such a good story.
So I would agree with that. I think that we happen to have two superpowers. One is being Latina and the other thing is being female. I think that there is such a wide space, like a white space right now in the content opportunity and the brand building opportunity, seeing how much of a driving force Latina consumers are and female consumers are. And the insights that feed whoever cracks that understanding of what Latinas love and what moms love truly is capitalizing on a golden egg. So I think that understanding my culture, loving my culture, loving cultures in general, and understanding how to present them in a way that people will find appealing is absolutely, definitely one of my superpowers and something I cultivate in the studio as well. It's important to bring on creatives who love culture and who can design and present at a world-class level. So I think that's definitely important.
I think it's such a personal thing. And so I grew up with a very mixed background with a Mexican mom that raised me as a single mom, but my dad is Greek. And I felt like I was never either. Like I was never Mexican enough to hang out with the Mexican kids. And I definitely didn't look like the only other people in El Paso were Jewish. So I wasn't that either. So I feel like, you know, for me, the identity, I didn't realize like how much I was Latina until I went to college, I think. Mm-hmm. And then I just realized all the things that Anglos did that I didn't know about. I was like, oh, I was doing a lot of other things. And I, you know, I didn't really realize it because I don't think I felt very accepted by it in mm-hmm. general. But I think 100% it completely changed my life in the most important ways. My grandmother was just this powerful, incredible matriarch and was just a feminist of her time. And without that kind of a female role model who happens to be Latina, but just who was this mm-hmm. badass, ran everything about our lives, and who, when I was 4 years old and I said, you know, Abuelita, I want to be president of the United States, she was like, absolutely. We are. And, like, I mean, the entire family was like, we should all start planning, right? Like, she, you know, we're going to go look for, you know, the inaugural dress. Like, the whole family was like, who's going to be on my security detail? Who's going to be in the cabinet? And I don't know. I mean, she was just this really important person in my life, but I don't think I understood, you know, that as a Latina, like, or necessarily embraced it until as I got older, I realized it, to be really honest.
I didn't know that I was a Latina when I got to this country, actually. I started going to grad school, and people were like, well, you can dance? Yeah. Well, like, you're Latina. Like, you're really Latina to me. And so I started to realize that there are a lot of programs in this country that promote diversity. And I was like, well, I guess that I'm going to take advantage of those. So, yeah, I'm Latino. And it has been, to me, it has been a huge source of satisfaction and a huge source of support. Coming here by myself, not having anybody to rely on, and having a very bad English, having that Latino community to you know, to go to and start making connections there was really, really important in my career. And I relate with your story a little bit, and then I started to understand that there is a lot around, like, Latino matriarchal structures that really, like, gave me this personality that I embrace. Like
a voice. Like, I have an important voice.
Yeah, yeah. So same. It's a similar story. My grandma was the youngest of 14.
Wow.
And she left Tucumán, which is a small place in the north of Argentina. She wanted to be a teacher. And they decided that she was not going to be a teacher because her sister got raped in the train, so we're going to forbid trains. And so she was like, well, I'm going to take that train, but I'm never going to come back. And she did that, and she traveled 3,000 miles back to Argentina, back to Buenos Aires, and that's where she grew her family. And growing up, she took everything she had to pay for my education. And that really shaped my personality, that go-getting thing that, like, if somebody's going to tell you you can't do this, then you're going to go do it, and you're going to just do it better than everybody else.
Wow. Wow. That deserves wow. But all of you deserve it, because I think the common thread, though, is for all of you, this was an advantage in some shape or form, and a big one. And I love the fact that many of you said there is some female matriarch role in your lives that sort of defined this as well. So I think there's, like, a story of women that goes on multi-generational. So this has been going on for a long time, maybe even before we talked about diversity and inclusion. I think that's very interesting. I'm going to restart with the Carolina number one and say, can you tell us a little bit more about your business journey, sort of your first company, now that has led into IQ then, and sort of what is it about your business that was exciting at first and exciting now?
So we have, like, two, like, in both of my startups, I have female founders with me. So we have, like, two barriers that we have to overcome when we started, was to come into the U.S. as a Latino entrepreneur, not only, like, to be, like, a female entrepreneur, but a Latino is hard. It's hard because you have the accents, because you have the contacts, because you don't have the network, so open that doors was really difficult. And then we were female entrepreneurs. That is also something else. I think that I am more related with fighting with the part of like being female in a world that was male dominated. And I have a lot of experience with investors and that were really like something that I didn't imagine it could happen to me. And the first thing that we understand was that if we are located in Latin America, one thing that was really good to get into the US market was first to have a proof of concept with the American branches. So we start working with Maybelline in Argentina, and Maybelline in Argentina become an ambassador for us and present to Maybelline US and to Maybelline Canada, and we start making business in the US. It happens with four accounts, so we spent 5 years making that model, working first with really big accounts in Latin America to be able to open us doors in the US. So after 5 years, we have like the first US client who was Ulta. So they end up buying us. And in the middle of that journey, we applied to every incubator in Latin America, and then we start in Silicon Valley, 500 startup, plug and play, because we need to belong. We need to have like our network here too. That was really important. We need to spend a lot of time here, and that was the way we achieved to fundraise in the US. That's like game changer for a startup, because in the Latin America, you get a valuation that is half or like less than half that you can get here. So they get all your equity. And so we fight really hard also in Latin America to achieve to have high valuations at the moment. And we were like two female entrepreneurs. That's something that every conversation comes to that too. One time, one investor in Silicon Valley said to us, you have like the worst thing, the worst combination. You are female and you are from Latin America and you are in your 30s. You are going to become a mom in like 1 year or less. And of course, he didn't invest on us, but it was a conversation. And I was like, okay, like moving forward, the next one, I don't want to speak with you anymore. I don't want to change your, I am not going to spend my energy changing your mind. I want to speak with people who is open about that. And the first person who gave us a check in the US was a woman from Stanford. So it was like the first $50,000 from the US, and that gave us $500,000 from a man. But it was the first check was for a woman. So women, you need to start.
And I follow
support, yes.
I follow Cara's career, and you also got the, when you were pitching, they take out your ring, so people might think that you are not going to be a mother soon.
Yes.
Right? From a mentor.
And Latin America is much worse in terms of like being machista, you know, like
chauvinist.
Yes.
We all understand that.
So I think that right now at IQ, I am doing both strategies. I am working with clients in Latin America, but I am coming here because I already have a reputation and I already have a network here. But it is really hard, and also because I have an accent, and you can notice that. And for the people in the audience who are in like in big corporations, please have the guts to start working with people who have an accent and opens their doors, because we can sell you great technology at a really good price.
You know, I actually want to say one thing about the accent, because I also have an accent. I'm actually Italian, but I have an accent the same as you. I mean, maybe you can take me into the Latina community as an honorary member. I would be honored to be part of it. But anyway, and I do speak Spanish, so that's a saving grace. But I would say, you know, a coach one time many years ago when I was working at Goldman Sachs told me, because I had the same problem with the accent, yeah. And he actually said to me, do not try to eliminate your accent, because I started going to the village to the school for actors to erase my accent.
Did that, yeah.
Oh my God.
And he said, absolutely don't, because Americans have a very short attention span, and it is statistically proven that they listen to people with a foreign accent for 7 seconds longer, which is an eternity.
Yes.
And so with that, it was encouraging me to keep the accent. I kept the accent.
Okay, thank you. I will keep it.
Sorry for the little awesome. Pause there. But so actually, as a nice segue to what you were saying, I'm going to go straight to Carolina number two, because you were talking about financing and raising capital, and you're one of the few Latina women that are working in venture capital and are financing companies and entrepreneurs. So tell us a little bit about sort of your philosophy, what you encounter every day as a sort of financier, so to speak, and also how does it mean for you to be a Latina woman and helping other women and other Latinas grow their businesses. So talk a little bit about what it means for you and what it means vis-a-vis the people that you invest in.
Yeah, so one of the things I've noticed when I first started in venture, it wasn't even on the path. Like, I'm very privileged and lucky that I can deploy capital. But in my role, K4 Capital actually was an investor in Uber, a company you may have heard about. That was one of our investments, so we've done pretty well with that. But then we focused, in 2012, we changed our focus to invest in diverse and kind of unobvious founders, as well as companies that are kind of building the world we want to live in, so impact companies. So that's what we're focused on now. When I first came on board, I didn't see a lot of Latinos come in to pitch us. So rather than, you know, anecdotally I saw it, but then I actually needed to present our fund performance to all of our partnership, and I actually saw the statistics that they were the group that least came to the office. And we were now this kind of diverse and inclusive organization, but Latinos were not pitching us. So I didn't really understand that, but rather than complain, I realized one of the things I needed to do is actually create ecosystem. So in order to get people involved, they need to feel like they belong. So we started this initiative, or I started this initiative called Latinx in Tech around startup weekends. So they're basically 54 ideation hours that you come together and you put a group of people and you kind of try to MVP or do a prototype of a tech company. And we rolled that out about 3 years ago to 10 cities, including Mayagüez in Puerto Rico. And then last year we had a conference where about 400 product managers, engineers, VCs all kind of came together that were Latinos in tech. But it's not just investing. I realize my job has to be more than just deploying capital. It has to be going to where communities are or helping build out ecosystems. So I also do that in Latin America, which is a very chauvinistic and machista culture. I will say that my dad's Latino as well. But I think a lot of the stories that you shared, having been a founder, they're true. And a lot of people try to hide the fact there is harassment. There are a lot of biases in how people relate based on what schools you went to. If you have an accent, there is actually research behind that. So I think what we do at our firm is we're very intentional about democratizing access. So anyone that wants to pitch us, we actually look at all the website submissions now. We read everyone, whereas most traditional firms will actually just put them away. If you don't have what's called a warm intro, someone to introduce you, they're not even going to give you the time of day. So we think about access in terms of building ecosystem, as we did with this Latinx and tech ecosystem, but also making sure that are accessible and we have open office hours. So that's part of it. Was there a second part to that question?
Well, part is like, I guess you answered both parts. So how did it feel for you to be a Latina as an investor, and what do you do for the ecosystem? But I think you kind of covered it, unless you want to add something.
Major sense of responsibility, because I was on the other side of the table. So I remember, and as an investor, I feel like I have a lot of empathy, having been a former founder, of all the mistakes that I made when I was first starting out, because I made, and I really appreciate Katia as a leader sharing vulnerability, because like vulnerability is too real strength and anchoring yourself in your power. And I think a lot of people, especially in our communities, don't talk about that.
Okay, then I'm going to ask, as a segue to that, a question to Katia, but then to actually all of you. As you think, because obviously this is a panel on entrepreneurship, but not everybody in the audience is an entrepreneur. I'm not an entrepreneur either, sorry. But we try, I think we all try to be leaders in what we do, irrespective of the fact that we own our own company or our own business, or whether we are inside Lilly or inside a large organization. We all are trying to change the world in our own way. And so if you think about your own experience as entrepreneurs and the traits that you have developed as entrepreneurs in your business, what would you recommend the people in the room that are not entrepreneurs that they take from the entrepreneurial spirit and they apply to their job? What is most relevant, do you think, for everyone?
My opinion is resilience, which I define as like just being knocked down over and over again and being willing to get up. And I think, you know, my experience, which it sounds like some people related to, is that I've never, for some reason, I've just never really been that afraid of being knocked down. And I think it's because if you don't come from a lot, you're not so, like, the fall doesn't feel far. People try to ask me, like, why are you not afraid? Why are you not afraid? I'm like, I don't know. I didn't have somebody telling me that I had to go to Harvard, that I had to, you know, I didn't have that pressure. And I just, like, anyone who doesn't have that, like, yay, embrace it. It makes you not feeling like, you know what? It is not the end of the world to not, like, be an entrepreneur, to fail, you know. When people are like, were you so afraid to start? I'm like, no, I just started getting afraid recently. You know, stakes started feeling high, but I didn't feel it. I really didn't. And I think it's because I didn't have that pressure of, like, there's one definition of success. That, you know, and I feel really lucky, but I think I now realize, like, certain people are just resilient, you know, and then certain people will learn over time, and what you figure out is these things that feel like they are going to end you, right? I had, was that me or you?
Me.
I laid people off, right? Like, one of the worst days of my life, I had to do layoffs in 2016. And literally thought that was going to be, like, it. Like, I was going to die. Like, it just felt like that. And when you face something that feels like you will never recover, and then just, like, the world goes on, and you recover, and you start to realize that this is just the path. Like, you have to get stronger. You have to, you're unafraid at first to fail, but you have to keep that fearlessness of, like, I will get past this. Fearless is wrong. Just recognizing that it will pass, like, will push you to being scared again. Because then the scared doesn't stop you. The scared is like, this is what it feels like when I'm trying really hard, and I might fall. But you know that you'll then get up. And you have to just do that a lot of times before you start believing in it. And even on the times when you're like, not this time, this time it's going to, you know, you have that, you remember. You're like, this is a pattern. It does pass.
I just want to piggyback on some of what she said. So I'm number 4 out of 5 kids. And my mom was very conservative Catholic. I think that the only expectation she had of me was, you know, to be a virgin until I got married. And that was it. Very much. There were no professional expectations set for me whatsoever. And I feel like because of that, like, I could do whatever I wanted, and worst case scenario, I would mooch off my mom for a bit. Like, it really...
And they kind of wanted it.
Yeah, and exactly. She was like, come home and teach. And I was like, I'm not going to teach, Mom. But then the funny thing is, when you go, and when I came to New York when I was 17 with nobody else in New York to study art, and, you know, and everyone tells you, what are you studying art for? You're going to starve. And so then you realize, like, and then, you know, I'm thinking to myself, there's nothing worse than, like, a mediocre artist either. But if I doubt myself, I'll be a mediocre artist, right? So it's almost like fear became very quickly a luxury I couldn't afford. Like, I couldn't afford self-doubt. I couldn't afford fear because that would just hold you back. So it was just, you know, focus on doing what I want to do. And if I fail, well, we'll tackle that then, right? But then, focusing on the initiatives that make people good, that work for companies, this is my second venture, and I would say, having worked with, like, really hundreds of employees, I really think that foresight, cultivating foresight and cultivating initiative are some of the best things that you can do as someone who's working at a company that will be really, really valued by your employers. People who I love, and in Kensals we do this, to surround ourselves with people that we consider to be smarter than us, right? That can bring ideas to the table, that can solve things in ways you wouldn't have thought of, right? That see problems coming, that take the initiative, that bring them to the table. All of those things are super, super important to company owners.
I would say raise your moral standards and make the people in the organization to raise them as well. I worked in corporate America for years after school. Like, I worked in Nike, Under Armour. I was the general manager of Mercado Libre, which is like the Amazon of Latin America. And all those organizations have really good intentions, but I struggle to find real purpose. And I think that, without pointing anybody in particular, but sometimes they reframe their purpose to just be liked by Wall Street. and the public in general, but the true impact of those organizations is really limited. And so when I start working for, when I start like shopping around to for my partners, my only request was, we're going to have real impact. We're not just going to say it. We're going to try to elevate people, and we're going to bring people from unprivileged backgrounds with us. And that was like the only big thing that I hold to. And I partner with the people that said, yes, we're going to do this, and we're still doing it. And it's hard to raise funds when you are less profitable than the rest. And it's hard to raise funds when you're like having all these social programs. And it's hard to like look at venture capitalists in the eyes and saying like, yes, your return on investment is going to be lower than the average in the market, but we're still going to multiply it by 100 or 10, whatever. But we're gonna follow that moral compass that brought us here. And I feel like as part of organizations, if you have the ability of question and raise that moral compass, you should do it.
So my advice would be to create a network of mentors and connectors. For me, being an entrepreneur has, like, the last 8 years, I have really low points. Without these mentors and without these connectors, it was impossible for me to overcome them. And you can feel really lonely, as you say, being an entrepreneur, because you can say to your employees, I don't know if I'm going to pay you in like 3 months. I don't know if I'm going to have the money to like to support the company in the next 3 months. And you need people that you can trust and you can be honest, because you spend so much time giving the best image of you to investors, to clients, and everything is good, even if it's perfect. And you need to have mentors and connectors. And for me, it's like I need female mentors as much as I need male mentors in my life. I need both. So I would recommend to create that in the journey of like being in a corporation and or being an entrepreneur.
And then I would say I started out in investment banking. So I ended up working in corporate for 3 years. But the level of speed that things are done when I went to work at a startup are like unbelievable to me. So I literally, it was like a huge culture shift, right? So I think anytime there are ideas, be open to new ideas, and especially from folks that are junior, and be willing to advocate and support those, because ultimately, like, the real innovation is going to come when you let people be open to being creative versus running very bureaucratically. I will say, in my experience overall, our companies, and even some of the ones that are further along that we've invested in, they're still thinking about how they can innovate parts of their businesses or even have separate strategic groups or innovation labs to be able to do that. So I would most definitely encourage that. And then the last thing I will say is around mindset. So even though my parents were super entrepreneurial themselves, I mean, they moved to, instead of moving to Miami, they moved to an all-Jewish neighborhood in Long Island so I can get rid of my accent. I will say they, when I went and it became a founder, they thought it was the craziest thing. They're like, yes, it's a startup. We don't understand. Why do you want to start a company? We don't get it. But ultimately, they ended up shifting perspectives. But what I think is really important is my mindset. Like, similar to you, I didn't really know what to call it, but now I realize is how you think about it. We have a choice every day to move in the world a certain way, to be happy, to be sad, to be excited. And I realized if I was coming from a scarcity mindset, I wasn't going to move forward. So my mindset is a growth mindset. So implementing anything in your corporations around that, I also think is fundamentally important.
These are all excellent points that we'll summarize later. But one thing I noticed as you guys were talking, a lot of you come from like a STEM background, banking, you know, all of that. But Susie, you are the artist. And so I think for you, tell us a little bit, how do you leverage a background that is a little bit different, if you wish, from the one that most people probably here have, to become an entrepreneur? And how does that make you different in any way? And how was that journey? Because so it is different from most.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. People. It took me a really long time to accept the entrepreneur mantle, because as artists, we like eschew capitalism and money and that kind of thing. But I kind of fell into advertising, which is the best school in the world. And I realized that if you have a talent for art, you can create something. You don't have to just talk about it. You can actually show it, right? And if you come from the School of Advertising, you know how to leverage creativity to solve real business problems. Mm-hmm. So I found that I really enjoyed solving real business problems with creativity. So what Encantos allows me to do is solve real business problems doing what I love, leveraging culture and serving the community. So I feel like when you have those four circles of do what you love, do what you're good at, make money, and serve the community, you've really kind of hit your stride. So really, being an artist and with an entrepreneurial mindset has given us all kinds of, has given me flexibility and a nimble ability to solve problems visually and present visually that I don't think I'd be able to do if I didn't have come from that background.
And just a fun fact, I want to say, K4 Capital has invested.
Yes, they have. They are fabulous.
So the idea of non-obvious founders, yeah. Right? This is a perfect example of it.
That's awesome. Yeah. To you. You've been very vocal about the fact there's not enough women, Latina, but women in general in the tech industries in particular. Mm-hmm. So what can we do in practice about that? What is the advice to change and accept? I would say things are changing. I think we're all saying that things are changing.
Slowly.
Just too slowly. But how do we, exactly.
Really? Yeah, exactly. Too slow.
And too, that's way, the point exactly. There, we're way further behind than I think any of us expect.
Exactly. Yeah. So the big question is, how do we accelerate?
Yes, it's accelerating.
I think by the way, that's true in finance where I work. That's true in a lot of
everywhere
business sectors. I think nobody can deny that over time progress has happened, but not nearly fast enough. And so what is the advice from you? And frankly, we probably all have a point of view here.
Okay. I think we need to bring more men to the conversation. It has to stop being just a group of women talking about rights and bring more men advocate that are actually convinced that has economic value for a corporation to have a more diverse and more points of view on the table.
Yes. Let's stop tugging at the heartstrings and start talking about money.
But it is a business opportunity. It's absolutely, and it's been proven over and over again that diversity is a business imperative because it makes a more intelligent mindset and approach to solving a business problem. Which is, people are slow to get that, though.
Yeah, and once you show them, earnings per share in more diverse corporations are higher, then it is an economic value to it. And so even if it would be great if it were, the moral implications of it. But if it not, then I do believe that we need more advocates within the organizations at every single level. And then it starts with the younger generations. I think everybody heard of the banbossy.org campaign, this idea girls at middle school are not interested in leadership positions because they don't want to be called bossy. And just because they want to be liked by the boys. And boys do not like bossy girls. And so if you call a girl bossy, it's like a swasher. You're telling her that she shouldn't be leading. And when a guy is trying to do it, then it's great, he's a leader. And if the girl is doing it, she's too ambitious. And so if we start erasing consciously those messages to our children, then we are changing the world, at least for the next generation. But there are still a lot of hidden biases that we don't even see. It's on us to educate. I'm in the board of a public company in Mexico. There are 22 old dudes and myself. And
I'm sure they love you.
they love me and they interrupt me constantly. And so I had a very nice conversation with one on each of them without trying to be pushy about it, but trying to explain that if I have a point of view, it would be really nice to finish my idea. And they are more conscious and they are doing the best they can. Now they don't know if they should open the door or they don't, so they don't. They're really lost. They don't know what to do. But at least I brought the conversation to the table. And slowly, slowly, they're being advocates of these little ideas that I'm, by inception, I'm, planting in their little heads. And they're, bringing a little more diversity into the corporation. And I think that this is what we need to do. We need to bring men to the table and educate them on why this is so important. for the society that we want to build.
So one thing that you said that resonated to me a lot, definitely agree we need to have male allies and we need to stop pulling just at heartstrings. There's an economic argument. The other thing I will say, it's narrative and storytelling. So if there are corporations that are in the media, this is really one of the reasons that we made an investment in Encanto, because you need to actually see girls as leaders, right? Latina girls as leaders. The more we tell those narratives, where I remember walking into Forever 21 with my niece and the t-shirt said, "Math sucks." That's bullshit, right?
Yeah.
But we paint those narratives and they exist in retail, but we actually need to change the capital stack, more angel women investors, more women across the table all investing, women investing in VC funds, like all of it needs to be done and we need to move collectively forward to do it.
And I personally think that there is a huge problem of throughput. So like I think we start with a lot of women and you tend to see a ton of like balance in universities in the beginning of organizations, and then right around the time of childbearing, everything stops. And I think it's a shared responsibility between women and men, but there's a severe throughput problem because the decision point where you come to is, in my opinion, like there is this moment where you realize you have to start over to prove your commitment to an organization. So like my ask to everybody here, we all have this bias, is to try to fight it, right? Like you immediately, you get pregnant and you're like, but I promise I'm committed to the organization. What happened to your brain in that moment? Like you're awesome. And by the way, I can promise you, mothers are like your secret weapon. We are so powerful. The first 6 months after you have your first child is extremely disorienting, but you have another 60 years of productivity ahead of you. Could you give us the 6 months of disorientation? We get much better at it after the first
time. Can I just piggyback onto that? So I have two kids, a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old girl with very strong executive skills. But aside from that, I will say that once I became a mother, and instead of working 14-hour days, I started working, 7-8 hour days, my decision-making skills and my level of ability to prioritize things just went, they got so sharp. You quickly figure out what's important, what's not important, how do I solve this, boom, boom, boom. You just get sharper because you have to get sharper.
And I think you yourself, the person going through it, and the corporation, you both discount your ambition in that moment. And if we could just go in with this expectation that you as an individual, this person, did not become less ambitious because they're bearing a child, which arguably is ambitious.
Yeah,
right.
Very much so.
That's the point.
Yeah.
One last. I agree. Very ambitious. We all share that view. One last quick fire question before we open it up to all of you. So start preparing your questions. I want to know very quickly from each of you, what inspires you in general, and when was the last time you were inspired? You could start, whoever has an answer.
No, start Marina.
Okay, start first time. Because we always have Carolina first. Too much pressure. Go.
What inspires me? Well, I told the story of my ancestors, like seeing like true social mobility in my story. It's inspiring. So my work and what I do every day. Then my business partners who have like very high moral standards, and they keep me real and the impact that we wanna create. And all these women, like seriously.
Last time you were inspired is now.
Yeah, I mean, the last time I got inspired was like listening to some of the stories. Truly,
that's great.
So I get inspired a lot by art. Like I love the latest Carolina Herrera collection, inspired by Mexico, which I thought was beautiful. So I love like whether it's films or whether it's fashion or whether it's podcasts or just inspiring either stories or ways to leverage culture. I think that stories shape culture and they're fundamental to society and how we develop. And I think as a creator, it's really important that we tell compelling stories that matter, which is back into Canticos. I mean, why Canticos matter so much? Because we're really showcasing Latin culture in a way that needs to be showcased in Trump's America. So I get inspired by stories and how stories get told and how they make a difference.
I am inspired by humanity. I really am. I'm inspired by the fact that humans like seek to progress, and I'm extra inspired when the pursuit of just getting better is done with joy. When people find joy in the pursuit versus joy in where they're heading, it's a personal objective and something I strive for. But when I see it happening, when I find that people are just like really joyful in this pursuit, it's just like, I'm just like, humans are amazing. It's like you're trying so hard, you're working so hard, and you're definitely failing. And yet you see the beauty in how you're growing. Or somehow implicitly you're feeling it, and I'm just like, damn, yay.
I would
and
say,
right now.
Oh. Well, most importantly, inspired by all these bosses on stage with me. But also, I think what fills and warms my heart is always going back to Peru, where my family is from, and just connecting with nature and also seeing the ingenuity of what people can do with so little in some of the most challenging political times when they have very little access to stuff. So I think of the privilege, and I'm humbled by it, that I have to do what I do every day in my life.
I get inspired by stories of women like these ones. I really like believe that role models is something that we need to work, and we need to make the time to create the stories and tell them to other generations, because you need that inspiration. You need to read like the stories of people who really enjoy what they are doing, who believes in their products or in their companies, and they only have that they really believe on that, and they keep doing. And I really believe that, like, us as a women founders and people who are a minority, we need to come up with the stories. We need to go out loud and tell them, because other people will need that.
Wow. With that, questions from the audience? I don't know. Oh, please, right here. And the microphones are coming around.
Hi, my name is Anais Carmona. I'm in the government affairs shop at T-Mobile, and it's a pleasure to meet all of you. I'm also from El Paso.
Yay!
So my question to you is, to a couple of you. A couple of you have worked in corporate America and also have to assert a value to your company when you do, for example, sell or when you're negotiating. Can you talk about the importance of being a woman in negotiating, whether it's the salary or the value of the company you're selling or the product that you're selling?
Yeah, the value of being good at negotiating is what you're, and I mean, selling is a really big part of your job, whether you're in sales or not. Learning mm-hmm. how to get people to come over to your perspective is so fundamental, and I don't think it's necessarily a feminine thing. I think it's challenging for anyone to hear no, but if you are trying to move yourself, you know, in your salary, if you're trying to sell anything, you have to go in expecting you are going to hear no, and you have a decision point. You either decide that stops you, or you decide that that was just somebody saying a word and you should keep going, right? And so I really think that the biggest challenge when you're going for something is that you are going to hear a lot of opposition. Just as context, I'm not exaggerating. Every person that we ever told the idea for Birchbox told us it was a bad idea, that nobody would ever purchase a sample. It's one of the, I mean, if you see what's happening now around the world with this business model, I mean, that was wrong. And it, really smart people, Harvard Business School professors, venture capitalists, the beauty industry, like everybody told us no. And I remember, this is a really inappropriate thing to say, but I'll just say it. I told my team that, like, that no means yes, only in the context of business. But it became a slogan. I was like, we got in the room. It's definitely going to happen. Right? Like, they let us in. They didn't know what stopped them. This is now I have the opportunity. So here's my advice. When you're going in to negotiate, just remember two things. You start the approach by thinking about how the other person feels like they're going to win, always. Only 50% of the time should be you talking. 50% of the time is information gathering, because remember, your expectation is the answer is no. So you need information to come back to get a yes. And it might be a long road, but that's my
Anybody else wants to add to that?
Even in my job, I don't have my function is in sales. I'm constantly selling because we invest in companies. So let's say Katya came. I would have to advocate and get the partnership and sell them on why they should make the investment. So I think just for negotiation, like come again, this mindset. I've been like, I have a coach now. I think if you can get a leadership coach, it's been the best thing, unlocked a lot of my potential. I go in with a mindset of, what is it that I want? But I don't go with a mindset that it's I win versus the other person loses. It's like how you can actually get to a compromise, right? But I always kind of lead with something very bold. And again, the assumption is I'm going to get backtracked to a no, but there's always a middle that you can come in between where both parties win.
I hear there's a question over there. I see.
Hello, my name is Valeria. I'm the founder of AlphaQuest. And what I do is I help organizations build their multicultural pipeline. And Carolina, this is a question for you. I'm also from Argentina, by the way.
Carolina one.
You mentioned that you said something about knocking doors on corporations, and you're looking for those doors to open. And in my personal experience working with corporations and small businesses in the U.S., while you know, in the supplier diversity area, there is a huge opportunity. While diversity and inclusion has been making significant progress in this country, supplier diversity is still a huge gap. If you think about salaries for Latinas, a Latina makes half of what a white man makes in this country. If you look at a business, a white man makes 10 times more revenue than a Latina in this country. So my question for you and others in the panel is, we have so many corporate representatives and professionals in the room, what's your ask for them? What can they do to open that door for you? What do you need?
That's a good question. So I think what is happening right now, like, of course, corporation sales take a long time to happen. So to come up here with a proof of concept, of course, it helps because it makes more quickly that path and makes more credibility. But in many times, they are afraid to hire people that are not located here. They are afraid to, like, start working with other, I don't know, time schedule. They are afraid that your engineers are not going to be able to speak good English if you are not speaking, like, really good English. So what am I going to expect for the rest of the team? So they didn't ask that question. So they are not, like, direct with you. They didn't ask you that. They start, like, moving around and ask you, the wrong questions. To try to figure it out if that is going to be a warrior or not. What I am asking is, like, be open, like, really, like, you have perhaps your team, your tech team could be not here, could be in Miami, could be in Texas, could be, like, everywhere. So you need to take the risk and try to work more with startups that are not located here. They are going to have huge benefits.
When I sell to corporations, I said it a couple of years ago, and I had a huge imposter syndrome. Like, I felt like I had to prove myself all the time. I felt like in a constant beauty pageant contest. And the only way is if they try. And so my ask was, give us a really small project. I'm going to take it to my engineers in Mexico, Chile, and Colombia. We're going to develop it. If it works, then we go for the big thing. And it has worked really well. Now we're working with Procter & Gamble and Y&R, but with all of them, we started with, like, really inappropriate, but shitty side projects that no one wanted to take, and then we grew into the organization through trust, like creating that trust through, like, actual things. I think it's the only way.
Thank you. Other questions? Right here.
Hi, my name is Carolina Linares. I'm the CMEX CEO and president of Future Creators, which is what we call the Future Movement. And I've been reflecting a lot on what it means to be Latino. I was just coming last night from a Code conference, which is a big tech conference, and I realized that out of 500 people, I wasn't the only Latino person. I was the only person
represent and to project comfort and to, you know, to showcase our identity to other people who don't know it, to be the examples. I really think that's an important part of our role in society. So I would never, I mean, if you have that fear, stamp it down, you rise above it. Just really know that you are a part of this American tapestry and you are what makes this country great. And just own that, know it, and represent it.
Yeah. So I would. Yeah, you have to anchor yourself in your strength. I think that's really important. But I get fear every day. And to say that I don't would be inauthentic. So the reality for me is I started trying to create community because there are so few Latina VCs. I found as many as I could, and I literally created a WhatsApp group called Las Comadres. And we literally just asked ourselves guidance, like, on little things, and I share. So I think it's really important to find your safe space and your supporting group. And sometimes those people may not even be Latinos, and that is okay. Because, like I said, I grew up in an all-Jewish white neighborhood in Long Island. So I didn't come to being Latina similar to you until I was older and going into college. I think it's important for you to also take the initiative to figure out creating a support system for yourself.
I mean, did you just hear yourself? You're so bad.
You're a boss.
I mean, it's so refreshing to hear somebody as successful as you admit that. And I think talking about that would just make more people realize that they could be you because you feel scared sometimes.
Yeah, it drives the people like me that are telling stories to tell more stories to make to uplift people like you because there's not enough stories in representative in culture that celebrate people like us. And that's a whole other thing. Please.
In a second, let's do with the mic, otherwise we can't hear your questions.
Hi, I'm Vivienne Harris, one of the two friends of doctor at Whole Life USA. It's part of Hello Dola DVD, and we launched specifically for Latino here in the States. And I've been thinking so much about this question because it's something I struggle with constantly in the marketplace, especially in corporate America, where yes, they're recognizing the importance of the Latino market, how valuable it is, yes, how quickly we're growing and all that good stuff. But all of you at one point or another talk about the importance of telling our story and the importance of creating these narratives and making sure that these narratives really reflect the diversity within our diversity. And as a brand that is trying to do that, I struggle so much and feel so alone at the time going out to corporations and saying to them, we don't just have to reach into the general market. We deserve to tell our story ourselves. And you're saying, like, don't tug at the heartstrings, show the money. And I can show the money all the time, but it never works. No one believes me. They don't believe that we exist. They think we're unicorns. I mean, you right now just admit it, that you yourself don't fully sometimes see yourself in the way that you are and how powerful you are. How can we, as Latina, all, or Latino, or for that next, do we start to demand more from people? Do we now have a responsibility to say, I'm going to support brands that support me?
Absolutely, yeah.
And how do I get away from
it? Absolutely.
Okay, so if that's the case, I'm curious, because I'm sure we've all been in this position. What happens when a brand says, yes, we believe in diversity and equity, but then they don't invest in you, they invest in the general market?
I mean, that's just one conversation,
oh,
right?
It's,
I mean,
it's,
I mean, my point is like, fight's not over, right? You just keep going.
Fight's always on. And
yeah. I think the ask is, like, I have a very similar experience to hearing the no, is that you just, like, start small. You know, you just, like, get your foot in the door. You get the contract is small money at first, a small amount, and you prove that this was an outside, you know, that there is a return. And once you start to have, like, I mean, I'm happy to help you with great extrapolation from case studies. I'm really good at that. But once you have case studies and you can start to say, like, look, what, first of all, I'm the kind of person that produces results. And second of all, I, like, know how to measure them, and I know what's important to you, and I keep coming back, and basically, I don't hear no. I honestly think a lot of people eventually said yes, because I was just like, here I am again.
18 months in advance, 24 months in advance. Okay, but like, how much money are you making when you give them your sample? I can tell you how much you're going to make with me. I'm going to place an order that reflects what conversion is going to be. And so just like continuing to be, and every time you go, you get